Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
And I'm Flora Lichtman. Today in the podcast, some bumps for a longstanding NASA mission.
The frustrating part is it's been a couple of years now that we've been trying to figure out how to get this mission on the books.
We're talking about NASA's Mars Sample Return Mission. That's the ambitious project that aims to use the Perseverance rover to collect Martian rocks and sand and even gulps of Martian air, and then through a complicated handoff between different spacecraft, return those Martian samples back to Earth. In 2023, a review board said that the original plan to bring the samples back home would be much more expensive and take much longer than originally planned. So this week, NASA announced two options on how to cut costs and bring the samples back to Earth by the late 2030s. But the agency did not commit to a plan, leaving it to the next administration to sort out. So is the mission on the rocks? Joining me now to get us up to speed is my guest, Dr. Jim Bell, professor of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, based in Tempe, Arizona, and distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Dr. Bell, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on, Flora.
Okay, Jim, so what do you make of this announcement of these two possible plans with no commitment to either? Is this a good sign for the future of the mission, a bad sign, neutral? What's your take?
Well, the good news is that NASA is supportive of doing this mission, continuing to try to find ways to bring these spectacular samples that the Perseverance rover is collecting back to the Earth. This is been the highest priority that's been identified by the National Academy of Sciences and the planetary science community for this next decade. The frustrating part is, as you said, you know, it's been a couple of years now that we've been trying to figure out how to get this mission on the books.
Yeah, so why has it taken this long to even just get some possible plan Bs?
Yeah, I think the reason is it will be the most complicated robotic mission that NASA or any space agency has ever attempted. It's a hard thing to do. And there are pieces of what need to be done, the big lander to go back to Mars, a rocket to launch the samples off the surface, an orbiter to rendezvous with those samples in Mars orbit, bring the samples back. The pieces exist from past missions, but putting those pieces together, as you alluded to earlier, is incredibly complex.
Yes.
And hard things take time and hard things take a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it reminds me of like a relay in, you know, in the Olympics or something. Like you have to pass this baton to all these different spacecraft, robot to spacecraft. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Or that game Mousetrap. I don't know if you ever played that as a kid, where you get all these different parts, you know, and this part has to integrate with that part and hand over to that part. And the ball has to keep moving forward. In this case, the ball is a collection of at least 30 amazing samples, very carefully selected by the Perseverance rover team on Mars.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So, you know, this mission has two parts. Part one is collect the samples. Part two is send them back to Earth. So your team is working on part one, working with the Perseverance rover to collect the samples. What are you looking for? Like, what makes a good sample?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've thought a lot about that and started thinking about that, you know, a decade ago when the mission was sort of dreamed up and thinking about where to send it. You know, think about where would you go on the Earth to collect samples, to learn about the early history of life on Earth and the environment of the planet as a whole. And it's a tough problem. And there are, you know, dozens and dozens of places that were proposed. And ultimately, we chose a place that, you know, was by Earth standards, we thought would be considered habitable a long time ago on Mars. An ancient delta, an ancient crater lake, a place where there was water ponding and flowing on the surface, where there were sedimentary rocks preserving anything that was flowing down into that lake. And, you know, on Earth, deltas like the Mississippi River Delta, those are amazing places to preserve evidence of biology and life. And maybe that's true on Mars, we thought. And so we've been trying to sample sedimentary rocks, mudstones, sandstones, delta deposits, the soil itself, and the basic kinds of chemistry and mineralogy and the rocks, the the volcanic rocks, really try to get a snapshot of an ancient environment that may preserve evidence of past life or past habitability on Mars, and also will tell us lots, we believe, about Mars just as a planet itself.
So Perseverance has already collected the samples, is what I'm gathering.
Many of them, not all of them, but we've got more than 20 now collected.
Do people fight for it, or they're like, "No, I want this delta," and someone's like, "No, I want this mudstone."
Fight, yes, in a collegial way. We're all on the same team, so you know, there's lots of heated discussions about, you know, do we sample here? Do we drill there? Do we drive left? Do we drive right? But in the end, we're all working towards the same goal.
So where are they stored? Is there like a little hidey hole somewhere on Mars? Is there a shoebox in the rover? Yes. Where do you put them?
There's two places that they're stored. The main place is inside the rover, inside the front of the belly of the rover. There's a tray and an entire collection of sample tubes and a little tiny robotic arm. I think about it like a little tiny Tyrannosaurus Rex arm inside the rover that moves those sample tubes around. They can pick them up and deliver them to the drill and the coring system, and then collect them from the coring system and put them back into the tray and seal them hermetically. So most of the samples are stored in that tray, but 10 of the samples have already been dropped onto the surface. And so as a contingency, as a just in case the rover doesn't survive long enough to transfer the samples to this Mars sample return lander, in case that doesn't happen, there are 10 of them out in a very flat parking lot kind of place in the crater that we're at, just spread out across the surface, and a future mission could go pick those 10 up if we can't get the primary samples out of the rover itself.
Sample takeout. They're just waiting for them to be picked up.
That's a great way to think of it, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so NASA had this press conference talking about how to possibly get these samples back. Can you just give me a high-level overview of the options?
So, as you mentioned earlier, the plan of record, it just has proven untenable in terms of schedule because the samples wouldn't come back until sometime in the 2040s. And in terms of cost, because some estimates of cost had it over $10, $11 billion. So the plans put forward are a combination of try to trim the size of some of the components, lower the costs, use more what NASA calls heritage components, pieces that have flown into space before, like the Skycrane system that landed the Curiosity and Perseverance rovers on Mars. NASA engineers and others were able to sharpen their pencils and reduce the size of this rocket that needs to take the samples off of Mars and lower the mass and get it into the sort of realm of being able to use the Skycrane and other kinds of equipment. So that lowers cost. And the other part of it is bringing in more involvement of commercial space, companies like SpaceX or Intuitive Machines, Firefly. So there's a big commercial space industry out there that is eager to get involved in NASA science missions. And while I don't know all the details, I know a lot of us are looking forward to seeing what parts of the commercial space world NASA can bring in to help solve this problem.
Best case scenario, when do you think we might see these samples back on Earth?
Best case scenario for me is like the second half of the 2030s, hopefully before 2040.
Are there people who are like, I will not retire until these samples come back?
Yes, sign me up. Yes.
Is that you? Are you that person, Jim?
I'm among them. Yes, I absolutely want to see. I'd love to see the dust on Mars with my own eyes and studying it with telescopes and spacecraft for decades. But, you know, more importantly, there's a lot of amazing lab equipment and skill here on Earth that has been working on lunar samples and meteorite samples and asteroid samples, ready to get samples from Mars and uncover those secrets. And so the sooner we get those samples into amazing laboratories around the world, the better.
So imagine these samples have just arrived in the lab. You're unboxing them. What would that moment feel like for you?
Oh, Christmas morning. Right. I mean, one of the realities of being involved in space exploration is it takes a lot of time. It takes years, decades sometimes of your professional career to realize these kinds of missions and their success. In the case of bringing back samples from Mars. It's been something that hundreds and hundreds of people have been working to try to make happen literally for decades.
Because this is the way that we would figure out whether there was life on Mars, right? Like, this is the way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, unless something just gets up and walks in front of our cameras, you're absolutely right. There's, you know, we don't actually have any evidence of anything like that happening, and we don't expect it, because life on Mars appears to, if there was life on Mars, it probably existed very early in the history of the planet. And we know from our own planet that the early history of life on Earth was very simple, single-celled, multicellular colonies of organisms, soft-bodied, no fossils. And the traces of that early life on the Earth, on our own planet, are incredibly difficult to find and study. And our expectation is that's going to be true on Mars. And so the best that we can do is go to a place that has the best odds of preserving that subtle evidence, and then get those samples into the same kind of laboratories, the cutting edge laboratories on the Earth that study that subtle evidence for early life on our own planet.
That's just about all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jim Bell, professor of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, based in Tempe, Arizona, and distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Flora. It's been a lot of fun.
Don't go away, because after the break, we are going to close the loop on a very important question.
We found that hula hooping isn't even understood at a basic physics level.
Support for Science Friday comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world.
As you know, we strive to bring you the most important science news stories of the week, the stories you absolutely must be looped in on. And there's one more we just couldn't drop, a new paper that clears up a long-standing mystery about the hula hoop. Specifically, why doesn't it fall down? Researchers at NYU looked into the head-spinning physics and math of hooping, and as a bonus, they investigated what body types make for the best hoopers. I'm not going to leave you hanging. Here to tell us more is my next guest, Olivia Pomerank. She's a PhD candidate in mathematics at New York University and an author on this new paper. Welcome to Science Friday, Olivia.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Why hula hoops?
So there's actually evidence of hula hooping in the human historical record as far back as 500 BCE. It shows up for the first time in ancient Greece.
Wow.
Yeah. So it shows up kind of again and again throughout history, independently in a myriad of different cultures. It's used as a form of recreation, religious ceremony, even exercise. And even today, artists and performers can do some really impressive stuff with hula hoops. And so we were actually just kind of inspired by just sort of seeing performers in Washington Square Park right outside NYU. And we figured, oh, hula hoops must have been sort of studied to death at this point.
That was your assumption?
Yeah, that was the assumption, because it's been around for, you know, millennia. But it actually hasn't been. We dug into the literature, just kind of driven by curiosity. And we found that hula hooping wasn't, even understood at a basic physics level. And so previous studies have sort of looked at the problem sort of from a top-down view, like in two dimensions, and studied the kind of twirling dynamics, but nobody's answered the really obvious kind of glaring question, which is, how does the hoop even stay up? And that's the question that we kind of set out to answer.
That does seem like the fundamental mystery of hula hooping. Why doesn't it fall?
Exactly.
Okay, tell me how you figured it out. I hear there are robots involved.
Yes, there are robots involved. So it seems like all of the forces kind of exerted during hula hooping should be directed horizontally, right? It's not immediately clear what's counteracting the gravitational force that's pointing down. So what's keeping it up? And so we sort of guessed that the shape of the body executing the hula hooping may be important. And so we 3D printed a bunch of different body types in order to test, maybe about the size of your hand.
Okay.
And we made a cylinder, a cone, so pointy part facing upwards. And then we also made basically an hourglass shaped body. And so We basically gyrated each of these. So that means translating in a circle without rotating it, drove that robotically, and just by hand tossed plastic hoops around each of the bodies.
Tiny little baby hula hoops.
Tiny little baby hula hoops, exactly. So it's definitely a funny looking experimental setup.
Okay, so it seems like there's two questions. There's like, what's the best body shape to keep a hula hoop spinning? That's one. And what is the answer?
So the answer is basically that you need to have sort of a sufficiently sloped and sufficiently curved body. So translating that to humans basically means that you need kind of hips, which provide slope, as well as a waist, which provides curvature. And there's sort of a sweet spot in there where the hula hoop will sort of naturally want to sit just below kind of the narrowest part of your waist. Then the hoop is sort of resting almost on like a tiny little sort of surface.
A ledge, your hip ledge.
Exactly. And so there's a tiny little force pointing upwards if you have slope.
So that's it. That's what's counteracting gravity, your hips.
Exactly. Exactly. Your hips. And then the reason you also need a waist and hips aren't enough is that it's not enough to just counteract gravity. You also need the hoop to be sort of trapped in place. And so if you have a waist and you have sort of a curved profile, then you actually get the hoop to be trapped in place. So if it goes up a tiny bit, it'll be pushed down. And if it goes down a tiny bit, it'll be pushed up.
I love that there's a physics answer to this. When you defend your dissertation, will you be hula hooping the whole time?
There is a chance that I bring one along as a prop. Not the whole time. Definitely not the whole time. I don't know if I have the hula hoops prowess necessarily to do that.
Olivia, thank you so much for closing the loop on this mystery.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk about this kind of stuff.
Olivia Pomerank is a PhD candidate in mathematics at New York University. And that is about all we have time for. Lots of folks helped make the show happen, including
Rasha Aridi,
Sandy Roberts,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
Danielle Johnson.
I'm Flora Lichtman. Thanks for listening.